it was really helpful to just like be hugged by my mom, just as I experienced all of that again.
This process is already timely, expensive, and a very heavy lift. Well, this bill will take the bar from very high to all but impossible.
Every time a manatee swims by, a fish swims by, a bird swims by, it creates that dust because the grass isn't holding it down.
From the fourth floor of the Capitol Rotunda, you're listening to WFSU Public Media's Capitol Report, the podcast. I'm Tom Flanagan.
Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. HR Florida State Council, affiliate of the Society of Human Resource Management, advocating for the workplace on behalf of 16,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council. More at hrflorida.org.
This is Capitol Report, the podcast. I'm Tom Flanagan. At least some students at Florida State University headed back to class this morning after that shooting last week left two dead and six injured. Regan McCarthy spoke with the students over the weekend about how they're feeling as they return to campus.
For Olivia Wyszynski, the idea of heading back to the classroom feels nerve-wracking.
It's a little bit more intimidating to think about finishing the semester and like going back to class. Like, I haven't opened my computer because I don't know how it's going to make me feel, but I still have exams to study for. So, I have to face that reality at some point.
The junior nursing major says she was on the second floor of the student union building on the day of the shooting. She heard someone yell, "Call 911. At first, she thought it was a medical emergency.
And next thing I know, people were just rapidly leaving. And so I also left. I just went down the stairs. And by the time I reached the bottom, it was just desolate. And I didn't know what was going on. And so I just left the union, ran down the steps, and I ran down the path towards my car. And as I was going, I heard all the shots.
Over the weekend, Wyszynski's mom and sister came to visit her. She says they've been walking through campus looking at the memorials where students and community members have piled flowers, candles, and notes in recognition of the tragedy.
We intentionally did it yesterday, me and my mom, because I didn't want coming to class on Monday by myself to be the first time I came back to campus. So it was really helpful to just like be hugged by my mom, just as I experienced all of that again. But we decided to come again today.
Another student, Caleb Miller, also spent Sunday back on campus. He was off campus in his apartment when the shooting happened. Even so, he says being back on campus is filled with emotion.
Very quiet, very sad, very sensitive.
Miller says his classes have been moved online, and he's glad to have that flexibility. But he also says he thinks it's important to go back to campus. He says that's why he's here on this day, to, as he says, try to get over the fear.
I know the school can't just close down forever, like, these things happen everywhere, but it's just about recovering and trying to get back to being a good, happy university that we all love.
The university's offering flexibility to students who are not yet ready to return, including working to make more classes available online and approving excused absences. FSU President Richard McCullough sent a video to students and staff.
I know this will not feel like a typical week. It's the last one before finals, and many of you are still processing what happened. We understand that.
McCullough encourages students and staff who need help to reach out for support. Additional security will be present on campus throughout the next several days. I'm Regan McCarthy.
Following the deadly shooting last week on FSU's campus that resulted in the death of two people and those multiple injuries, House Democratic caucus leaders are calling for stricter gun legislation in Florida. And we get that story from Adrian Andrews.
During a media availability Monday, House Democratic Minority Leader Frances Driscoll of Tampa condemned the Republican-controlled legislature for not passing more rules to make guns and ammunition less obtainable.
Democrats in our caucus filed good, common-sense gun laws, reforms that would help to make our community safer. And unfortunately, the Republican majority refuses to even give them a hearing.
Democrats in both chambers have filed bills this session to tighten the state's grip on guns. Parkland Democratic Representative Christine Honchowski has a bill awaiting its first hearing that aims to regulate gun ownership by requiring background checks on all firearm sales. It also prohibits the sale of guns that don't have a serial number. Honchowski was Parkland's mayor during the 2018 shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School.
If you haven't been through something like this, it's very hard to understand the level of trauma that people who have been through this are experiencing. This is the time to make sure that we have the resources we need, but also making sure that in the future something like this doesn't happen again.
Meanwhile, the Florida House in March passed a bill to lower the gun purchasing age from 21 to 18. It's a rollback from a law passed after the Parkland shooting. The gun purchasing measure has stalled in the Senate, but Florida's Director of Gun Owners of America, Luis Valdez, hopes the bill will pass.
Gun Owners of America is fired up to see the House pass HB 759, marking the third straight year in a row now that lawmakers have voted to repeal Florida's unconstitutional under 21 purchase ban.
Gun advocates say increasing gun control doesn't necessarily work to keep weapons out of the hands of criminals. Some say the shooting on FSU's campus may be an example of that. Currently in Florida, a person must be 21 or older to purchase a handgun, but the FSU gunman was 20 years old. Authorities say he used his mother's old service weapon. She is a Leon County Sheriff's deputy. I'm Adrian Andrews.
A Florida Senate bill would make it more difficult to get a citizen's initiative on the ballot. A key provision would ban the use of public funds to advocate for or against an issue that is the subject of a proposed constitutional amendment. A companion bill in the House wouldn't go quite that far. This discussion comes as Governor Ron DeSantis spars with the House over accusations that $10 million in Medicaid settlement money landed in the coffers of a political committee whose position he shared. Margie Menzel reports.
DeSantis fought hard to defeat proposed amendments 3 and 4. The latter would have broadly legalized abortion. The other would have legalized recreational marijuana for adults. He won both battles in November. Now, Pensacola Republican Representative Alex Andrade is leading a House investigation into Hope Florida, a nonprofit organization led by First Lady Casey DeSantis, who is considering running for governor next year. The question is whether Attorney General James Uthmeyer, DeSantis's former chief of staff, committed criminal fraud and money laundering by using funds from Hope Florida to aid the fight against the marijuana amendment. Meanwhile, the House and Senate are deep in discussions of bills that Democrats say would end the process of altering the state constitution. Republicans backing the bill say the groups behind last year's marijuana and abortion amendments polluted the process.
It has been taken over by out-of-state fraudsters looking to make a quick buck and by special interests intent on buying their way into our Constitution.
Fort Myers Republican Representative Jenna Persons-Mullica points to a report by the State Office of Election Crimes and Security. The office, in its January report to state leaders, said the state makes it easy to register and vote, but hard to cheat. It also noted that petition fraud has been a concern since the Florida Constitution was revised in 1968 to allow constitutional amendments by citizen initiatives. It identifies two groups behind Amendments 3 and 4 as having violated election laws last year.
We have already seen evidence of fines over the last couple of years, including, as I said, a letter that went out to Smart and Safe Florida just within the last couple of weeks, fining them $121,850. The Floridians Protecting Freedom were fined last year $186,000 for violating our current law.
Persons-Mullica is the House sponsor of a bill that would change the process of gathering petitions to put a proposed constitutional amendment on the ballot. It would require the voters signing petitions to provide sensitive information, such as the last four digits of their Social Security number or their driver's license. It would require supervisors of elections to notify voters who sign petitions that they have the right to change their minds. it would slash from 30 days to 10 days, the length of time the groups gathering petitions have to submit them to election supervisors. And there's much more. Panama City Beach Republican Representative Griff Griffith says the bill is needed to push back on the propaganda machine behind the ballot proposals.
This report notes that 17 arrests have been made by FDLE. But what FDLE said is that the arrests and the subpoenas are hard to enforce because they're out-of-state contractors. Members, we don't want out-of-state money, corporate interest, and that like telling us how to put stuff on our Constitution or telling us how to vote.
Democrats say the fines show the process works and that ballot initiatives have been essential to measures such as raising the minimum wage and enacting free pre-kindergarten for children, policy changes that lawmakers wouldn't make. St. Petersburg Democratic Representative Lindsey Cross calls the provisions of the bill a death knell for citizen-led ballot initiatives in Florida.
This process is already timely, expensive, and a very heavy lift. Well, this bill will take the bar from very high to all but impossible.
What's more, the House bill leaves out a key point the Senate includes, that public money can't be used to advocate for or against a constitutional amendment. Orlando Democratic Representative Anna Escamani agrees with the Senate.
This bill cuts petition timeframes, adds more fine and fees, threatens people with criminal charges. And it's really just based upon the fact that we have seen these initiatives become more and more successful despite goalposts moving, and we're intimidated by that. And now we're attempting to make it nearly impossible to pursue. So let's be honest, members. This bill is not about integrity or transparency. It is about control.
The House bill passed along party lines. The Senate version is now being heard on the floor. I'm Margie Menzel.
On Capitol Report, the podcast, Tristan Wood joins us, and we're going to update a bit of information about a bill that we talked about earlier, Tristan. This is the one that would permit some employees in the state to opt out of minimum wage. And I remember the last time we were talking about folks who were in work-study programs or interns or like apprenticeships or that sort of thing. That's how it started. This bill is still working its way through the process, so where are we now, and is it different from what we talked about before?
Oh, absolutely. So the bill, when it first was going through, received a lot of criticism from other lawmakers and other industry groups, expressing concern that under the bill, the definitions of work study, internship, pre-apprenticeship, and apprenticeship programs were really lax, which would in theory, allow an employer to reclassify any job, like a bagger at Publix or a warehouse worker at Amazon, as an internship. And then that would allow them to pay people doing general work below minimum wage just by changing the name of how they categorize the job. There was also concerns that there was nothing in the bill preventing an employer from using a coercive element to force. And those were the two main areas that the critics of the legislation were voicing in the committee process.
All right. So have those been taken care of, and that's why this continues to move forward in the legislature?
Well, it's currently up in the Senate Rules Committee, which is the final committee stop before a bill goes to the full Senate for a vote. And several days ago, an amendment was filed that would address a lot of those concerns. One of the things it would do, would it would cap the length of time someone could have the minimum wage waived to 9 months or 2 semesters if it's for college credit. So the hope is to prevent that type of situation where someone's employed in an internship or work study program indefinitely just to pay them below minimum wage. This is will hopefully curtail that so that it will do the main focus, which is to give employment for more younger people or people with like less skills in a certain trade to be able to get those skills to then get higher levels of income employment later down the road. Additionally, there's also an explicit prohibition on employers using coercion to force employees to sign these agreements to be paid less. So under this new version of the bill, it can only be for 9 months maximum. the employee would have to give their written consent. And if the employee is a minor, they would have to get their parental consent to waive those rights.
We've only got this week and next week in the 2025 Florida lawmaking session. Any chance do you think this is going to make it through all the speed bumps and get before a final floor vote?
Well, as we're recording this right now, it's waiting to be considered, as I said, in the Senate Rules Committee. And just the fact it's being agendaed is a fairly good sign that it's going to at least pass the Senate. What happens in the House and whether the governor signs it, that's another question altogether. But it's looking pretty solid that this is the version of the legislation that will end up passing.
I have a feeling we'll be checking back with you and see how that progresses. Tristan Wood, our Capitol reporter here on Capitol Report, the podcast. Thanks, Tristan.
Nice speaking with you, Tom.
Finally tonight, one of the most unique things about Florida is its large number of crystalline springs. But pollution and overpumping of the aquifer are combining to cloud what Marjorie Stoneman Douglas once called bowls of liquid light. WUSF Steve Newborn takes us on a boat tour of one of the state's largest springs and explains how some people are fighting to keep them unique.
From atop a pontoon boat, you can see that Three Sisters Springs is a postcard picture of idyllic Florida. Swimmers float on foam noodles above manatees munching on seagrass in the clear water. The three crevasses where the underground aquifer flows into Crystal River are shaded a deep blue, but just a few feet away, the waters start to sport a tinge of green, as in algae green.
You notice the water's kind of dusty and brown.
Captain Mark Denzer is our pilot on a recent spring day. He says what causes the problem is a lack of seagrass. It was killed by pollution and Hurricane Helene's storm surge.
And that's because every time a manatee swims by, a fish swims by, a bird swims by, it creates that dust because the grass isn't holding it down. So once we remove it, any component of the rest of the ecosystem has to recover from it.
With 71 spring vents, Kings Bay is the second largest freshwater spring system in Florida and one of the largest in the nation. Nitrogen and phosphorus from septic tanks and lawn fertilizer spawns the growth of algae that smothers the eelgrass that is one of the anchors of the food chain for marine life, including Crystal River's famous manatees. People like Michael McGrath are hoping the state will take action.
Having blue springs and also green lawns, these goals are not mutually exclusive.
McGrath is with the Sierra Club of Florida. He helped organize this tour to help stop overpumping of groundwater that sucks up almost a third of the spring's historic flow. And he's pushing summertime bans on lawn fertilizer. Citrus County, where Crystal River is located, has a wintertime ban, but is considering one during the rainy summer months when runoff enters the springs. Several other counties, such as Hernando, Hillsborough, Pinellas, Manatee, and Sarasota, have similar bans. Statewide, 18 counties and hundreds of cities have them. But Ryan Smart of the Florida Springs Council says that's only part of the solution.
So when you look at where the pollution comes from, here in Crystal River, it's largely urban. It's primarily septic tanks, and it's primarily urban fertilizer.
Governor DeSantis has proposed $50 million in grants this upcoming year for springs protection. That includes about $5 million to convert septic tanks to sewer around Weekiwachee Springs in Hernando County. Smart says that's a drop in the bucket.
So at that rate, we're never going to be able to make a real meaningful difference. The extent of the number of projects that have to be done and the cost of removing those septic tanks means if that's going to be the solution, we need a lot more money from coming from Tallahassee.
Improvements can't come soon enough for Maxine Connor. She's active in the Sierra Club Adventure Coast, which includes Citrus and Hernando counties. Maxine's been coming to Crystal River since the late 1970s, and the changes have been drastic.
It was crystal clear. It was just absolutely amazing. When I moved up here in 2012, I was horrified when I finally came out here on the bay to see the changes.
And what did she feel when she moved back here?
Sadness. It's a shame, because it was a magical experience.
Recapturing that magic will take a lot of time and a lot of money. I'm Steve Newborn in Crystal River.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Adrian Andrews, Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Steve Newborn. Shows are available Monday through Thursday by 6:30 p.m. Eastern Time, wherever you get your podcasts. On many of these Florida public radio stations, you can tune in each Friday to catch the latest on all things happening at the Capitol. That show is also available in podcast form. Technical assistance comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report, the podcast from WFSU Public Media.
Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. HR Florida State Council, affiliate of the Society of Human Resource Management, advocating for the workplace on behalf of 16,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council. More at hrflorida.org. Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.